This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sean Hayes, who played Jack in Will and Grace, is making his Broadway debut in the revival of Promises, Promises, which opened this week. The show has songs by Burt Bacharach and Hal David, who we'll talk with next week. Two of the songs from the show became hits, the title song Promises, Promises, and I'll Never Fall in Love Again. The show premiered in 1968 and is based on the movie The Apartment. In the revival, Sean Hayes plays Chuck Baxter, an employee in an insurance company stuck in a low-level job. He has something his boss wants, an apartment in Manhattan, an apartment the boss can use to cheat on his wife with his girlfriend. So Baxter gives his key to the boss in return for the promise of a promotion. The revival also stars Kristen Chenoweth. Sean Hayes got his start starring in the independent film Billy's Hollywood Screen Kiss, which led to the role that made him famous on Will and Grace as the very extroverted gay friend Jack. Let's start with a recording from the revival of Promises, Promises, featuring Sean Hayes singing the title song.
Promises, promises, I'm all through with promises, promises now. I don't know how I got the nerve to walk out. Remember, I feel free. Now I can look at myself and be proud. I'm laughing out loud. Oh, promises, promises, this is where those promises, promises end. I won't pretend that what was wrong can be right. Every night I'll sleep now, no more lies. That I promised myself fell apart, but I found my heart. Oh, promises, they're kind of promises, take all the joy from life. Oh, promises, those kind of promises can just destroy your life. Oh, promises, promises, my kind of promises can lead to
Sean Hayes, welcome to Fresh Air. I really enjoyed your performance in Promises, Promises.
Well, thank you.
Now, I know you performed in the Encores production of Damn Yankees, but that wasn't officially Broadway. This is your official Broadway debut. So, you know, I've heard you sing comedically as Jack in Will and Grace, but here you're singing for real and singing well for real. Did you sing much before this?
No, actually, I think that's one of the reasons I did this, as well as 50 other reasons, most of which shall remain in my head. But one of the reasons was to challenge myself and see if I could really conquer this kind of thing that I've always been toying with, the singing thing. And I don't, by any means don't pretend to be a singer or label myself a singer. I'm definitely an actor first, but. But it's fun to kind of, you know, push your boundaries and see if you can do things that have scared you a little bit your whole life.
So if singing scares you a little bit and you're out on a Broadway stage singing, that's mm-hmm. got to be scary with a capital S.
Yeah, that's what life's about, though, isn't it? Isn't it about getting out of your comfort zone and getting off the couch and challenging yourself and forcing yourself to do things you wouldn't otherwise do? Otherwise, what are you living for?
Comfort. I'm living for comfort.
Well, actually, I'm realizing that now. Comfort never sounded so great.
Now, Burt Bacharach, I think, is a real stickler for precision in his orchestras and in his singers. Did he come in and do any of the coaching? I think he was very active in the original production.
Yes, Burt. Unfortunately, I don't know too much about that. Burt was unfortunately not available because he had some medical issues. I presume with his back and his spine. So the first time he saw the show was opening night last Sunday. And it was a pleasure to finally meet him. And he was, you know, overjoyed, and which was a great relief, you know.
Now, did you know some of the more famous songs from the show, like Promises, Promises, I'll Never Fall in Love Again, Knowing When to Leave, and two other Bacharach David songs were added to this production, I Say a mm-hmm. Little Prayer and A House Is Not a Home. How familiar were you with those songs?
Well, I knew Promises and I knew Never Fall in Love Again only from the radio from being a kid. And, of course, The House Is Not a Home and Say a Little Prayer. I was unfamiliar with the rest. And to be quite honest, the very, very first listen to those songs for me was the cast, the original cast recording. And a lot of them you don't walk away humming. But if you listen to it even a second time, let alone 100 times like I have, they really do grow on you, and you kind of gain a certain affection for them, and you realize why the show was a hit back in the 60s. You know, there's a couple songs that you don't, you know, go to the urinal during intermission and hum, but they really do stick with you.
Now, you do have a music background. You studied music, you studied piano, you studied conducting, I think. In college, you played a lot of Mozart. Mm-hmm. Why classical music?
I think that's just what came more natural to me. As a kid, that's what I started on. And, you know, talking about comfort zones earlier, I think that's where my comfort zone was. I was pushed to try to do jazz and other kinds of styles of piano, and I just didn't really get it. It just didn't really click. It didn't come as easy to me as classical did. Plus, probably the fear of improvising on piano. And, you know, with classical music, the notes are the notes. You either hit them or you don't. And they're right there on the page for you to learn. Whereas jazz, it's just here's a chord or here's kind of an idea, now go. And I never really learned that technique nor really had the desire to. I don't know why. Probably because I was afraid of the improvisation.
So why did you change from music to acting?
I think that was probably always my destiny. And I fought it because I grew up in a family of many brothers that won accolades for their sporting events and everything. And so I thought I was a little embarrassed to pursue acting at such a young age. And I thought it wasn't the macho thing to do, if I'm being completely honest. And so so I always kind of had this passion for it. I would always hang out in the theater as much as I could because those people made me laugh the most. I mean, I used to watch Saturday Night Live as a kid constantly and go, God, they look like they're having so much fun. Why am I not doing that? And so I think when I got to college, as do a lot of people, you discover who you are and find yourself more than you did before. You go, yeah, this feels right. This feels right to be amongst funny people and people who enjoy what they do. So I kind of pursued both at the same time. I was pursuing music during the day, and at night I would go hang out with all the theater folks, watch shows, and do improvisational groups and things like that. So I was on a two-way track.
Now, once you decided to act, your first real role was in a film called Billy's Hollywood Screen Kiss. This is an indie film with a lot of unknown people in it. Did you have any confidence that it would be good?
No. I at the time, I wasn't working. I just moved to Los Angeles and... because if you wanted to do TV or film, that's where you need to be. And I literally just auditioned and got the job like 2 days later. And my agent was like, do you want to do this or not? It's no money. It's nothing. And I was like, I'm not doing anything else. So I did it. And then from that got Will and Grace.
So before we talk more about Will and Grace, let me play a scene. One of the things about your character, Jack, is that he always wanted to have, you know, like a one-man show in which he'd sing, do a little dancing. And now that you've made your Broadway singing debut, I thought it'd be fun to listen back to Jack singing. And he had this ambition to do, you know, the show Jack 2000 and Jack 2001. So here's a scene in which he's trying to cheer Grace, who's sick and in bed. He's trying to cheer her up by singing.
Anyway, I find that the one thing that really makes people smile is my music. Or my oddly long tongue. Your choice.
Music.
Good! Because I finally figured out how to make Jack 2001 different than Jack 2000.
You going to get an audience?
No. I'm going to sing a medley of songs with the word one in them. Yeah. So let the healing begin. Hit it! You're still the one I want to talk to in bed. Hey, still the one that turns my head. You're still having fun, and you're still the one. Singular sensation. Every little step she takes. Skibala, skibala, ski. One. Thrilling combination. Every move that she makes. One less bell to answer. One less egg to fry. One less man to pick up after. I should be happy, but all I do is cry. Oh, Grace, you're crying. Oh, is it because of my song? I can't believe I made you cry.
It's okay.
Okay, it's great! I did it! I finally moved someone to tears with my art!
Sean Hayes in a scene from Will and Grace. How is your character of Jack described in that first script, the one that you used to audition?
Oh, gosh, I don't remember. But to me, you know, at the beginning of Will and Grace, I played Jack as the funny next-door neighbor type, as we've seen in the past. And I thought that was my role. I didn't really play into the gay part as much, the stereotypical gay part. And I have to say, the critics, for not being that educated about the gay lifestyle, I think pegged Jack as the flamboyant, extremely gay character. So, because they didn't know what else to call him. Because if Will is seemingly straight acting, oh, then Jack must be very feminine and very flamboyant. Whereas I wasn't playing him as feminine, because I know a lot of gay guys who are extremely feminine, kind of like Carson Kressley type from the, what was that, the Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. Those snapping kind of girly, that to me was stereotypical gay, the very feminine gay guy. But if you didn't label Jack as gay, and he would have just been the funny next door neighbor who was had a lot of energy the way Jim Carrey, Robin Williams, Marty Short, any of these guys did.
So so you changed your interpretation of the character as time went on?
Mm-hmm, definitely, 100%. Because I wanted to explore the I wanted more distance between the two types of gay characters, between Jack and Will. If you look at the first season, Jack's not – there's the mannerisms and the – a lot of the dialogue is more towards the stereotypical flamboyant gay guy. But a lot of the mannerisms aren't. And then as time went on, I added more and more and more and more.
Now, you've used the word stereotypical. Were you afraid that at some point you would be playing into a stereotype?
At that point, I didn't really care. I knew what was funny and what was true to that character, the growth of Jack, to that character. And so what was true to the growth of that character was to play him that way. That was so well written, you know, so well written.
Right before Promises, Promises opened, you did an interview with The Advocate in which you acknowledged you were gay, whereas previously you declined to talk about that, saying that the less people knew about your personal life, the more open-minded they could be about each role that you played. And I was wondering, like, why now?
So we wouldn't have to talk about it.
And so here am I talking about it.
Right.
Is that your point?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So can I just ask you?
Because it's you know, it's just there's nothing relevant about someone's sexuality to what they do for a living.
But what's relevant to me is that your first big roles, both in Billy's Hollywood Screen Kiss and in Will and Grace, were as gay characters. And mm-hmm. I think probably for a lot of young gay people in particular, it's great to have gay characters on screen because not until recently were there any.
Billy Crystal in the 70s on soap. I mean, there's tons of examples. But I think any positive that has come out from me playing gay characters in TV or film is amazing and a wonderful byproduct of you know what I've done. And if it's helped anybody, then my life is complete because that's a wonderful thing.
Well, one of the things that you did was a made-for-TV movie about Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. You played Jerry Lewis. Jeremy Northam played Dean Martin. And so you played Jerry Lewis, and you also did, like, Jerry Lewis bits in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you meet Jerry Lewis while you were putting this together?
I did not. I did not on purpose. I didn't want to be influenced one way or the other. I just wanted to stay true to the great script that John Gray wrote and directed, amazing writer-director. And John and I viewed countless hours of old Colgate Hour video from the 50s and a bunch of rare, footage of Dean and Jerry working together. And then I would go home and literally stay up till 2, 3, 4 in the morning, combining the Jerry Lewis bits while infiltrating some of my own kind of flair to the Jerry Lewis sensibility. And some of those scenes we wrote, I came up with the stuff entirely on my own with Jerry in mind of how would Jerry do this, with Jerry-isms, but new bits. So that was fun. And I got a big round of applause from Jerry, called me crying and saying he loved it and couldn't believe how true it was and real and for him. So that was great. I loved that job.
What did you most pick up on watching hours and hours and hours of Jerry Lewis?
What did I most pick up on? Very similar kind of sense of what I went through on as playing Jack and Will and Grace, which was how different the man was offstage than he was playing, as he called, the idiot. Jerry Lewis referred, I don't know if a lot of people know this, Jerry Lewis referred to his on-camera persona, whether in movies or TV, as the idiot. And so the idiot couldn't be further from who Jerry Lewis was. And I kind of can completely relate to that. Whereas people recognize me as the idiot Jack. But I don't see myself as that. I know others do, but I don't. But that's what I picked up most upon.
So why don't we hear a scene with you as Jerry Lewis? From the Jerry Lewis movie that was made for TV. And in this scene, Dean Martin, played by Jeremy Northam, is doing his act at a club, and you kind of crash the act. You come in dressed as a waiter and with a tower of dishes on your arm that you keep dropping, and they come crashing to the floor as Dean Martin is doing his act. So here's the scene.
And when I look up at the stars and ask them all what's new, they join me in the answer, darling, it's you, my own.
Excuse me, pardon me, I'm coming through, excuse me, pardon me, sorry.
My own.
Hold there. The hell's the kid doing?
I'm very sorry, kind sir. I didn't mean to interrupt anything.
Oh, no. I was getting kind of tired of that song anyway.
So was the audience, but I didn't want to say nothing.
Oh, wise guy.
Go ahead, Mr. Singer. Make like I'm not even here. I'm not here.
I wish you'd make like you weren't even here.
That's a scene with Sean Hayes as Jerry Lewis and Jeremy Northam as Dean Martin. So
that brings back great memories.
Does it?
Yeah, it was really fun to do that.
You know, I was wondering if maybe you didn't draw on what you learned from that just a little bit for your role in Promises, Promises.
Just like playing Jerry Lewis?
Just a little bit of Jerry Lewis in there, yeah.
Yeah, people have said that. I wasn't conscious, but if you picked up on that, maybe it was subconscious. But that's actually, I love that scene. That's a really funny story, true story, about how they began working together was Jerry saw that Dean wasn't doing too well with the audience at that time and wanted to kind of amp it up a bit and get the audience going. So he came in with plates and just started dropping. I mean, the guy was fearless. I love that. And that's how that relationship started. It was a beautiful thing.
Well, Sean Hayes, thanks so much for talking with us, and good luck with Promises, Promises.
Thank you so much.
Sean Hayes is starring in the Broadway revival of Promises, Promises. Next week, we'll talk with Burt Bacharach and Hal David about writing the songs for the show, songs like this one. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
What do you get when you fall in love?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The first edition of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass was published in 1855 in an edition of 795 copies. Whitman retitled it Song of Myself in 1881. My guest Robert Haas describes it as perhaps the most unprecedented poem in the English language. Whitman revised the poem through his life. Haas has edited and written the introduction to the new book Song of Myself and Other Poems by Walt Whitman. Haas describes Song of Myself as a poem about democracy and imagination and what to make of life and death. Haas was poet laureate from 1995 to 97 and is a two-time winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. In addition to the Whitman book, Haas just published a new collection of his own poems called The Apple Trees at Olema. His new book, Song of Myself, reprints the poem as it appeared in 1885 and as it appeared in the final edition from 1891 to 92.
The first few lines begin, famously, "I celebrate myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass." And in the last edition, he writes, "I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass." So he just made this really small change. He added the phrase, "and sing myself." In the first edition, it had no name. And then in the second, he called it Walt Whitman. And then I think he called it Walt Whitman, an American, for a while. And it really wasn't until the end of his life that he called it by the name that all school children know it by, Song of Myself. And I think it was at that point also that he added the phrase, "and sing myself."
Why is Song of Myself so important in the history of American poetry?
Well, a bunch of reasons. But the first one is it was the first experiment in extended free verse. Nobody had done that before. The thing that he took from English poetry, I think, was what the romantic poets like Wordsworth saying they wanted to write poems in the language men actually spoke, to get away from what felt like artificial in the diction of 18th century poetry. Whitman, who, you know, had an 11th, dropped out of school in the 7th grade and got his education as an editor and a typesetter, grew up with the language of newspapers, and he wanted a new kind of verse for a new country, and he imagined that that verse would be the rhythms of actual speech. So that's one very important thing, that first experiment. And the second reason it's important is because it's written at a particular moment before the Civil War, after the Revolution, of enormous optimism and hopefulness about the country. Some people have said Walt Whitman invented the imagery of the New Deal in 1855 by talking about this cascade of democratic images of all kinds of people.
What woman is always considered like, you know, the quintessential American poet? And he writes about the American city. And he writes about American diversity. I mean, Whitman was into praising diversity before our time.
Like, yes.
Diversity is so in now, but Whitman literally used the word diversity.
Almost invented it.
Yeah, and I want you to read an example that I think will give a sense of his love of the city, his sense of diversity, and also his you know, free verse, his lack of rhyme. Mm-hmm. And another thing it gives a sense of is how he'd often just do lists of things, just like tumbling lists of similar things that he wanted to talk about. So would you read this section for us that begins "The Blab of the Pave"?
Sure. Isn't that wonderful?
Pave is in pavement and blab is in blabber.
That was the fun of walking across the campus and think, what would the dictionary say about blab in 1850? Anyway, the blab of the pave, the tires of carts and slough of boot soles and talk of the promenaders, the heavy omnibus, the driver with his interrogating thumb, the clank of the shod horses on the granite floor, the carnival of sleighs, the clinking and shouted jokes and pelts of snowballs, the hurrahs for popular favorites, the fury of roused mobs, the flap of the curtained litter, the sick man inside borne to the hospital, the meeting of enemies, the sudden oaths, the blows and falls, the excited crowd, the policeman with his star quickly working his passage to the center of the crowd, the impassive stones that receive and return so many echoes, the souls moving along, are they invisible while the least atom of the stone is visible? What groans of overfed or half-starved who fall on the flag sunstruck or in fits? What exclamations of women taken suddenly who hurry home and give birth to babes? What living and buried speech is always vibrating here? What howls restrained by decorum? Arrests of criminals, slights, adulterous offers made, acceptances, rejections with convex lips. I mind them, or the resonance of them. I come again and again.
There's several phrases that are changed in the final version, but most dramatically, the last phrase of that section you just read. So would you read the last phrase of the original and the last phrase of the final edition?
Yes, the last phrase of the original is, I come again and again, and the last phrase of the final is, I come and I depart.
What does that difference mean to you?
My guess is that he's an older man when he's writing the last version of the poem, coming and going. And so the first version says, I come again and again. I'm here. I'm always here. There's another line in the poem that says, surge and urge, always the procreant urge of the world, that the continuous presence of the sexual energy of living. And in the last version, I come and I depart. It means everything's coming and going. I come and it's more Buddhist.
it's also, I think he knows he's nearing mortality. He's not going to be coming again and again.
Yeah, he was writing one of the last sections of the final version of the poem. There's a section called Sands at 70, and then another called Last Annex. So he was getting near the end and thinking about it.
Now, you mentioned in your introduction that Emerson, who was a champion of Whitman's early on, got kind of tired of that list-making, that cataloging that we hear in the excerpt that you just read. What why did he get tired of that? How do you feel about that constant list-making?
Well, I think everybody gets tired of it. The thing about Whitman is, I think what Emerson said, I thought he was going to write the great poems of America, and he wrote the catalog. at that time when they arrived as regularly as they do now. He overuses the technique. I mean, he celebrates abundance. He's an incredibly abundant writer. I think when I began reading him without a sense of how terrific the best of the poems were, I thought he was kind of a gas bag, partly because of this endless list thing. When you look at it in the poems, this like Song of Myself, when he's at the top of his form, every single image is very wonderful, vivid and amazing and accurate with the newspaper reporter's accuracy that he had. They flash before the eye like those illustrations in 19th century books, one figure after another, the policeman with his star quickly works and so on, all of that, all ways of getting at the city. But at certain points, he's listing anything he can think to list, and he loses me, but not in this poem. This poem is a miracle in the way that it keeps coming back to the sense of the enormous variety and abundance and diversity and vitality of life.
One of the things about Whitman is that he's in his own way, I think it's fair to say, like a mystic, where everything is embodied in everyone. Everyone embodies everything. But he's also like an egotist. So, like, I always find when I read Whitman, I never know like which part is like a huge ego and which part is this like great mystical exuberance. What do you think? Do you feel that way too?
Yes, I do. But I think that in Song of Myself, I think it's pure exuberance, and it is a mystical, someone said it's the only comic mystical poem, because the mystical insight at the core of the poem is, if you say it, it sounds banal, you know, it's here I am, and here we all are, and we all can feel our way into each other, and everybody is everybody else. And one response one might have to that is to say, no, you're not me. At some point in this period, he said about himself when he was writing these poems, I was simmering, and Emerson brought me to a boil. He was reading Emerson's essays, and he had some sense, you know, young guy from a troubled family who grew up and making it in the streets of Brooklyn, which is a huge exploding suburb, and of Manhattan, that he had this sense that all life is life right now, that everything is alive, and that it's to be celebrated, and the enormity of it is to be celebrated, and the surprise of it is to be celebrated. The shocking thing he says about that at the beginning of the poem is, I'm going to tell you in this poem that death is different from what anybody supposed, and luckier, which is the kind of joke at the core of the poem, that all life is eternal in the imagination if you act like it is.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you now to read something that I think really reflects that mystical streak in Whitman. And this is the section of Song of Myself that starts with, and there is no object so soft.
There is no object so soft, but it makes a hub for the wheeled universe. And any man or woman shall stand cool and supercilious before a million universes. And I call to mankind, be not curious about God, for I who am curious about each am not curious about God. No array of terms can say how much I am at peace about God and about death. I hear and behold God in every object, yet I understand God not in the least, nor do I understand who there can be more wonderful than myself. Why should I wish to see God better than this day? I see something of God each hour of the 24, and each moment then, in the faces of men and women I see God, and in my own face in the glass. I find letters from God dropped in the street, and every one is signed by God's name, and I leave them where they are, for I know that others will punctually come forever and ever. And as to you, death, and you, bitter hug of mortality, it is idle to try to alarm me.
I just really love that section of Song of Myself. It really speaks to that sense of everything being God. How would you define what you know of Whitman's version of spirituality?
Well, you got it exactly right. His mother was Quaker. His father was Dutch background from Long Island, and people have described him as a kind of radical working man rationalist, follower of Tom Paine. And Whitman's language is suffused with the language of Quaker spirituality, which is some idea of the family of man. But his religion at this point is that he sees God in everything.
There's a line I want to quote that I think gives the sense of my confusion between his egotism and his mysticism. Uh-huh. And also, it has a great, really earthy earthy phrase in it. He says, "Divine I am inside and out, and I make holy whatever I touch or am touched from. The scent of these armpits is aroma finer than prayer." But, you know, I make holy whatever I touch. I mean, does he see himself as particularly holy, or is he speaking for everybody, that everybody is holy?
He's speaking for everybody, but he gets the outrage and the comedy of it. He says, "I know no sweeter fat than sticks to my own bones," he says in another line. But he keeps meaning that it's so of everybody. And in fact, there's nothing very personal in this poem in that way. It's not the personal narcissism of the person who says, you know, "And another thing about me," this is a poem about everybody.
How hard was it for Walt Whitman to get these kind of radical for their time poems published?
Well, he had no trouble getting them published because he put up the money and did part of the hand printing himself. The poems were published in the same year as the Song of Hiawatha was published by Longfellow, by a respectable Boston publisher, and it sold hugely. And the first version of Leaves of Grass, according to his brother, I think he printed 500 copies, and it managed to distribute 5 or 6 of them. Getting it printed wasn't the problem. Getting himself read and believed in took some time, but by the end of his life, you know, he was a figure of some. He was certainly a cult figure, and he was a figure of some eminence. And there were writers from all over the world would come to visit him in Camden, New Jersey, in his last house there to meet the phenomenon of Walt Whitman. And I think that he made some money by having a brand of cigars named after him, so that his white bearded face smiling in his slouch hat appears on a box of cigars that I've seen at the Smithsonian, I think.
You have a lexicon in the middle of the book with mm-hmm. words from Whitman's time that we wouldn't understand, mm-hmm. but our knowledge of these words will help us appreciate what he was saying. Mm-hmm. And it's good you have it there. I mean, like, there's one phrase in particular where I found it really helpful. He says, "Through me the afflatus surging and surging." And afflatus, it sounds like flatulence. I don't know whether you say flatus or afflatus, but it sounds like there's flatulence surging through him. But afflatus or afflatus actually means the miraculous communication of supernatural knowledge, which kind of changes the whole feel of what he's saying there.
Yeah, it's a word from 19th century theology. It was fun to look and say, "Blab of the pave." Does anybody else use the word pave as a noun? No, is the answer. We looked in every possible source. Another place he says, "The kelson of creation is love." I looked up kelson. Whitman grew up on Long Island and then in Brooklyn, where there's a shipyard, so he loved watching guys build boats. And the kelson is the piece of wood that connects the rudder to the frame of the boat. Huh. So it was enormous fun doing the lexicon, because it got us a chance to look at exactly the way he used these words. And over again, they turned out to be terrifically precise. When the young Henry James reviewed the first or an early version of Song of Mice, Whitman would throw in foreign words And James, with a little bit of fastidious snobbery, said, "One must regret Mr. Whitman's too extensive acquaintance with the foreign languages," as a way of putting him down for the pretension. But and one example was, he talks about the rushing by in the street, the flaps of the ambulanza. But when we looked it up, it turned out that the first army to develop a service to get wounded soldiers very quickly from the battle to hospital tents was the Italian army, or the Piedmontese army, during the Crimean War. And the term for these very fast-moving wagons taking people to the hospital was ambulanza, and it was the newest, most cool word. So over and over, when I looked up words in the dictionary to see where Whitman was in 1855, there was always some surprising, interesting accuracy, or some area like the word afflatus or flatus, I don't know. Since nobody ever says it, how would we know how to pronounce it?
Here's something that really baffles me about Whitman, given his mystical streak. He commissioned a granite mausoleum. And I guess, why would you want that kind of, like, physical monument to your bones if you really believed in the divinity of everything and in the, you know, eternal presence of everything?
Yeah. I mean, it turns out he was a Victorian. You know, it was the century of the beautiful cemetery, and everybody had a terrific appetite for these marble mausoleums, and you know, turned out he's just like everybody else.
Have you ever visited
it's
the mausoleum?
It's true. It does. No, I haven't. And I think for me, you know, that the famous end of Song of Myself is, "I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you nevertheless, and filter and fiber your blood. Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere waiting for you." I think that's his burial place for me. I don't really need to go to the mausoleum. I take him at his word. He's under our boot soles.
Under our boot soles and on our bookshelves.
Yeah.
Just one more thing. I want you to talk a little bit about the impact that his free verse had on American poetry and how radical it was at the time. As you point out in the book, we take it for granted now.
Yeah. Well, the impact was slow. I think people associated the free verse with the lists, with the catalogs, and with the parts of Whitman's, you know, "I Hear America Singing" that sound like 19th century political oratory. So people didn't quite know how to deal with his free verse, and basically didn't for 50 years. Then in 1911, 1912, the young modernist poets started to experiment with free verse, which they thought of not as an American thing coming out of Whitman, but as an avant-garde technique coming out of France. And Ezra Pound wrote, who grew up in the not far from Whitman's country in Philadelphia suburb, wrote a poem called "A Pact." It begins, "I make a pact with you, Walt Whitman. You roughed it out, and now we're going to refine it," is basically what the poem says. So, and when people worked in free verse in the early 20th century, except for Carl Sandburg and a little bit Langston Hughes, they were working out of European models, not out of Whitman as a model. And it really, really wasn't until Allen Ginsberg wrote Howl that somebody took what Whitman had done and tried to do something more with it.
Robert Hess, thank you so much for talking with us about Whitman and for reading some of his work. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Robert Hass edited and wrote the introduction to the new book, Song of Myself and Other Poems by Walt Whitman. You can read the introduction on our website, freshair.npr.org. Hass also has a new collection of his own poems called The Apple Trees at Olema. We'll close with an excerpt of pianist and composer Fred Hirsch's album, Leaves of Grass, featuring Kurt Elling singing Song of Myself.
I celebrate myself and sing myself. I celebrate myself and sing myself. And what I assume you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me is good belongs to you.